Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the woman behind a new plan to create a savings program for long-term care, similar to Wisconsin's EdVest College Savings Plan.
First, we're taking a look at a special series being published this summer in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The series is a collaboration between the Journal Sentinel, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and the O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. It's called Poor Health, and it's about the link between poverty and health.
The reporter behind that series joins us now to discuss the connection and how it plays out in Milwaukee. Lillian Thomas is the assistant managing editor of special projects at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Lillian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Rob.
Well, part of the story you're telling is a story of the mission of hospitals and how that has changed. How did hospitals go from being something intended mainly to serve the poor, as you write, to a place that often avoids serving the poor whenever possible?
Well, we wrote about most hospitals were started as purely charitable groups, foundations, and were founded at a time when wealthier people had their own doctors, and hospitals were just for poor people and just for people who couldn't pay. Gradually, those hospitals, to meet expenses, began to charge patients. And then the next thing that really turned the corner was when private insurance and then government insurance became available. And suddenly, hospitals they weren't getting money from foundations or from wealthy donors or from patients. They were getting money from insurance. So that really flipped the whole way hospitals operated, beginning in the 30s and then really ramping up in the 60s with Medicare and Medicaid.
So they were competing for people with insurance, people they could make money from.
Correct. And also one of my hospital official sources said to me, once you began using other people's money, things changed because you no longer had an incentive to keep prices low, because you were being reimbursed by the procedure and you were being reimbursed for whatever you charged back in the day. So hospitals could make a lot of money and then insurers could make a lot of money. So there was just this incentive for a lot of people to jump into the market and start expanding.
And in the long term, you write that hospitals started closing in poor areas, poor urban areas in particular. When did that start happening?
Really began to see that in the 70s and ramping up a lot in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. The hospitals would have a poor reimbursement for Medicaid, and that changed because Medicaid originally reimbursed at about the same levels as Medicare and private insurance. But over the years, those reimbursements dropped, and so the hospital wasn't getting everything back for Medicaid patients. And in poor areas, most of your patients would either have no insurance, which meant you got no money from them, or that you would get a Medicaid-level reimbursement. And that made it harder and harder for hospitals to survive in poor neighborhoods.
Well, tell the story of how the hospital landscape, the healthcare landscape, has changed in Milwaukee.
What we really wanted to do was document with data what we felt in our guts we were seeing. I saw this in Pittsburgh and I saw it in Milwaukee. And we looked to map where hospitals were 10, 20, 30 years ago and where they started disappearing and where they started reappearing. And what we saw was what our research led us to expect, which was in poor neighborhoods, you lost hospitals like the public hospital in Milwaukee in the county, and St. Michael's and some of the other inner city hospitals. We focused on one which had various names. It was called Milwaukee Hospital and Lutheran Hospital and then Sinai Samaritan. But that hospital was serving downtown patients and eventually affiliated with Sinai, but then was shut down because it was struggling and having lower and lower patient counts. And as we also wrote, at the same time, because hospitals began to follow the money, they began to follow the wealthier, insured, privately insured patients, they began opening facilities in the suburbs. And that's a pattern we saw throughout the United States as the 52 metropolitan maps that we have on the project demonstrate, that you just see that in almost every single metropolitan area in the United States.
We've heard talk about food deserts where people don't have access to affordable, healthy food. Are we seeing healthcare deserts?
We really are. It's a little difficult to talk about in cities. And a lot of people I would speak to, hospital officials, would say, how can you call it a desert when 5 miles away they have a perfectly good hospital? But what we found when we started talking to people is, when you lose the hospital, you lose the doctors. The doctors go where they can be affiliated with a hospital. There's poor infrastructure. There's not labs. There's not other services they might want. And so if you live in a densely poor area, and particularly obviously out in the rural areas, you see real deserts where there's just no hospital at all. But in urban areas, what you see is people don't have the institution there. They don't have doctors. And if you're working a job and don't have daycare and have to take 2 buses and to get to a hospital, it becomes a bigger deal. Obviously, with if a big emergency, you're going to go to an ER, but even there, the time it takes to get can mean that your service is slower and therefore your outcome might not be as good.
You paint a picture to kind of put a face on how this works of a Milwaukee resident named John Patton Jr. He has a lot of health needs. Can you just describe his life as it relates to health care?
Sure. Mr. Patton was a very engaging man. I met him at a free clinic where he goes, and he's very upbeat, really works hard at trying to find work, even though it's mostly been odd jobs. He had an injury more than 20 years ago at a foundry and has really not been able to find full-time work since. One of his regular gigs is as a Salvation Army bell ringer, and then he picks up little odd jobs. But for him, he lives on the north side, and he walks to clinics. He uses the emergency room as his regular service because he doesn't have a regular doctor, although now he is enrolled in Medicaid, and so he will now really have a home medical center where he can go. But up until very recently, his life was kind of cobbling things together. He would go to one place and get some information. He would go to a free clinic, but they wouldn't necessarily have his full records, so they might just treat something that was presented that day but not know about what else he had going on. So I think that what his story really showed was how complicated it can be when you're a low-income person and you don't have the means or the time or the sophistication. It was also clear that he sometimes had trouble understanding his own conditions and navigating the computer and telephone trees that you sometimes have to do to figure out where to go for what.
How common is that to, as John did until very recently, not have that home, not have the main doctor who sees you every couple of months, or at least even once a year?
I think it's very common, and there's a lot of academic studies that have been done about people who don't have what they call a medical home. Their care is piecemeal. If something really bad happens, they go to the ER. And if something less bad happens, they might try to find a clinic, but that clinic might not have all the services they need. It's also very hard for these patients to get specialty care. So they go to a clinic, they have a condition where they really need a specialist, but there's no specialist there, and it's extremely difficult to get appointments with specialists, many of whom don't want to take Medicaid patients. So they get kind of caught in a cycle where they don't go because the service isn't very available. They wait till they're very sick, and then either they go to an emergency room where they're treated and often get very good treatment, but then they're spit back out in the street, and there's no guarantee that they will get the follow-up or do the follow-up care that they themselves need to remain in good health. So that's we see, and medical systems all over the country are seeing this problem of patients who, while they're poor, actually end up costing the system a lot of money because of that high use of the emergency room.
So you've outlined some of the challenges here. How does this end up in terms of outcomes? How much worse are people's health or maybe mortality if they're in these low-income urban areas?
What we documented in this series is this very powerful connection between poverty itself and poor health. While we were trying to show that there's health deserts and that sometimes people have trouble getting access, that's not the whole story. Even in countries such as England, where they have socialized medicine and people should have equal access, you still see the disparity between poor patients and wealthier patients. We see it in higher rates of chronic disease. We see it in higher rates of premature mortality and higher rates of all sorts of illnesses. So a lot of research has been done academically, again, on what they call social determinants of health. And that means aspects of living in poverty that directly contribute to poor health, as opposed to something that you get and your wealthier neighbor could get to. This is just something that you live with. That might be something like a child who has asthma living in an apartment with mold, so that it's hard for that child to get better because they keep going back to an environment that aggravates their problem. So that is one of the things that has been well documented and that we tried to show in the series, that it's not just access to care, but it's a very, very living in poverty that can lead to poor health.
We're talking to Lillian Thomas from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about her special series on health and poverty. It's being published in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this summer.
We're taking your calls next. Have you struggled to navigate the healthcare system in the United States? Do you live in a health desert? Are you in a low-income area with little access to healthcare in a city or a rural area? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now with Lillian Thomas of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about the special series she's working on that examines the link between poverty and health in Milwaukee and beyond.
And we're taking your calls now. Have you struggled to navigate the healthcare system in the United States? Do you live in a low-income area without a lot of access to healthcare in city or rural? Call and share your experiences. And do you work in healthcare, especially in one of these low-income areas? Call and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. To your calls in just a moment. But Lillian, I know one of the upcoming parts of your series is on solutions. Can you give us a taste of what kind of solutions are being floated out there, maybe being tried around the country?
Sure. I did quite a bit of reporting both in Milwaukee and Pittsburgh, but also in other cities where they're trying new things. And one of the major states that really is embarking on this is Oregon. They have an almost $2 billion federal grant to try to target Medicaid patients and figure out ways that they can both improve care and reduce costs, which would be the wonderful win-win that we would all like to see. And what they've been able to do is take the money and do things that aren't directly medical care issues. And sometimes they call it going upstream, where you try to address the social problem or the preventive problem rather than waiting until the patient shows up on your doorstep very sick. An example that I was given there that actually the governor of the state has used because he's a big supporter is you have a man who lives in a four-story walk-up, and he has a heart condition and a lot of respiratory problems, and he keeps having relapses where he gets very, very ill and goes to the ER and is treated and then goes home again, where he's in this hot walk-up and doesn't manage his fluids well and eventually gets sick again. What they decided to do was buy an air conditioner. They said, we're spending thousands and thousands of dollars treating this guy over and over. What if we spent $300, bought an air conditioner, and had a homemade check on him and help him manage his fluids? This person would be paid a much lower hourly rate than the ER docs and all the technical things that are being used to help him in the hospital. So that's the kind of pretty innovative things that they are trying in Oregon to catch people before they get really sick and try to keep them well as, instead of waiting for them to get very sick and show up in the emergency room. They are also experimenting in Oregon, and this is, we found in other cities too, with trying to use outreach workers who might go to the home, who might call people and do consults on the phone, or even just do simple things like remind them of appointments, of providing transportation in some cases, because as I said, sometimes low-income people have a great deal of trouble just getting to where they need to go. And so some places have experimented with vans to go pick people up, which is an expense for them. But if you don't have people missing appointments, if you get them in to see a primary care doc instead of waiting till they're sick, again, the idea is that you save money by spending some money in preventive or other kinds of services.
Well, good.
Go ahead.
I want to jump in and get to our callers now. We've got
sure.
Ellen on the line in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I do have direct experience of the American medical system's total failure and abandonment of working poor and uninsured people. My own sister this past June went into the hospital in Chicago with a very serious infection. She was she had successful surgery, and then because of being poor and having no insurance, she was sent to nursing care center that called itself a hospital, and there the care was neglectful, filthy, beyond my description trying to keep short here. I was there, and my other sister was there, and thank God my other sister is in the medical community. Otherwise, we wouldn't have even gotten, it was a battle every day to get decent care, which she never got. Therefore, she got weaker and weaker. She developed infections in that place. She was sent back to the hospital twice, back to Kindred twice, and on the third, weaker every time. And on the third time back to the hospital, we said, that's it. We're taking her to Milwaukee. She was in an apartment successfully for a month. Unfortunately, she fell and broke a bone. And I have one light in this story, and that is Sinai Samaritan Hospital was the place she went and where she was when she passed away. And the hospital was kind and skillful to both her and us, our family. But the previous 8 months were horrid.
Ellen, I'm very sorry about your story and sorry for your loss. Lillian, is that a case that you found around the country where sometimes even where there is access to some kind of health care, it might not be good, it might not be good quality?
Yes, I didn't focus on that because sometimes, as I said, the care is excellent, but the problem is the patient then goes home and gets sick again. But there is a two-tier system or a three-tier system, and I've talked to a lot of people about that question, saying, are we moving more and more toward this? And many academics and doctors will tell you we're already there, that people who can pay, who have good private insurance, get a very different level of care from people who can't. And that's not always true. As you said, Sinai gives excellent, excellent service, and many, many hospitals that serve the poor are excellent. So I wouldn't want to say that's always the issue. But certainly in many cases, the clinics or the institutions, long care institutions, are just not giving the kind of care that is the minimum that would be required to really do a decent job of serving patients.
Ellen, thanks for the call and sharing your story. And again, very sorry for your loss. Lillian, before I let you go, who is trying to fill in the gap in Milwaukee, say, where there's a perceived health care desert?
There are a lot of free clinics and also the federally qualified health centers, which are funded by the federal government and have some access to lower malpractice insurance and other things that make it possible for them to serve the poor. And there are also a lot of these free clinics. I think a lot of hospitals also are really trying to improve their access, their outreach, and sending nurses out into the community and setting up small clinics on the premise or close by. There's a lot of strong free clinics that are affiliated with hospitals. So I do think that there's many people who are trying to fill in the gap, but that there is a lot of money in healthcare, and the fact that, again, we see the building out in the suburbs means that that money is not going into institutions or to pay the salaries of people who might serve the poor in their own neighborhoods.
Lillian, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Lillian Thomas. She's Assistant Managing Editor of Special Projects at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We're talking about a series she's doing on the connection between poverty and poor health. It's currently running in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the world's largest music festival, Milwaukee Summerfest, begins on Wednesday. There'll be a lot of big names, but we'll check in on some Wisconsin acts that you shouldn't miss.
First, we're talking about a new idea here in Wisconsin that could help people to save for the care they might need when they get older.
A lot of people need help with everyday tasks once they reach a certain age, but less than 8% of Americans have long-term care insurance to help pay for that kind of assistance. That's one of the reasons our next guest is proposing a new way for people to save for long-term care.
Ingrid Thompson is with us. She's the director of McFarland Senior Outreach Services. Ingrid, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me today.
So how did you first get the idea to create a new way to save for long-term care?
Well, this came from my own personal experience. I have parents who are in the 90s, and they had paid into long-term care insurance. But when they needed it, they found that they had to go through a lot of hoops and red tape, and they had to submit paper after paper, and it became quite tiresome for them to get the money that they actually contributed to this insurance policy. And the other thing was my personal experience. As I was growing older, I was thinking that that would be a good option for me to have. But as I looked at my budget, I wasn't sure that I could finance it. And so I was really struggling with that concept, knowing that I thought I wanted it, but yet I didn't think I could afford it.
Now let's get to the bones of the plan. It has a lot in common with EdVest, which is a popular way for people to save for college. How does it compare? How does it work?
Well, that's the first thing I thought of when I came up with this concept was it seemed fairly simple that in EdVest, not only could an individual put money into their account, but typically it was other people. It was parents, aunts and uncles, grandparents that were trying to set aside some money for somebody's education. So in this concept, it would be where an individual could put money into their own account. This person would, the account holder would be 18 years old or older. But let's say I had a child that wanted to give me a Mother's Day gift and wasn't sure what she wanted to give me, so she deposits some money into my account. So this account would be, there would be an account holder, but other people who are interested in somebody's welfare and long-term care could contribute to this fund.
And so this is a group approach. This is sort of the village approach to long-term care.
Yes, it is.
Why do you think that we need a plan like this if there are already private long-term care insurance companies who can provide this or Medicaid, for instance?
Well, in terms of long-term care insurance, I'm in a subcommittee that has researched this, and we have found out that the long-term care insurance is probably going to be phased out. And the reason why they're going to probably phase this out is because they have found that it's hard to predict 20 and 30 years out what the cost of the various things that people need are going to be. And they sometimes can't predict what services are out there. So if I had bought my insurance policy 30 years ago, I might not have adequate coverage to be able to get what I need, or there might be some new services that have been made available to me that was not even part of the plan.
And the price of long-term care insurance is pretty well known to be rather expensive, and that's been prohibitive for some people. Do you think that this would address just the cost of it all?
We're certainly hoping so. Like I said, I think that people can contribute at their own pace. For example, if you have the long-term care insurance, you've got a premium. That's what you have to pay. Whereas if you have this savings account, you can put in $20 this month, $100 next month. You can do it at your own pace and when you have the funds available to you.
Can you give us a sense of why you think it's important and what the statistics have to say as well about why it's important that people save for elder care?
Well, there are a lot of expenses out there. Having worked with older adults for over 25 years, that's one of their scariest things. Do I have the money to cover the things that I'm going to need as my health declines? And they're finding that they can't. They can't exit as well as that they want to.
And I think that I read something that reflected a statistic saying that only 8% of people have long-term care insurance. Is that right?
Absolutely. So having an investment fund like this would open it up to a lot more people.
And what kind of response? You have this idea for this plan. What came next? Because now we're seeing it as a presentation in the paper. How did it get from your idea to where we are today?
Well, the first thing, I happened to be a member of the Wisconsin Aging Advocacy Network and presented the idea to them, and they formed a subcommittee to help me with this. And from there, we started to fine-tune it, and once we felt it was in the way we felt it should be and finalized as much as we could, I went to my legislators, which happens to be Senator Mark Miller and Representative Rob Cole, and I sat down with them and Laura Rose from the Wisconsin Legislative Council, and we went through it, and they were very intrigued with the idea. And from that point on, a draft was made of this bill, and the draft came back to me a little while ago, and I sat down with my legislators again, and we reviewed it, and we modified it and fine-tuned it. We're starting to do a little bit more research on it, and I'm hoping that I'll get the next draft of it fairly soon. And I've also presented it to the Dane County legislators in a separate meeting through another advocacy organization that I had. And so bit by bit, we're trying to put it out there and see what the public and the legislators think about this concept.
How unique is this plan as far as you know?
As far as we know, there is none in any state in the United States. We did some preliminary research, and we don't believe that there's any other state that offers this concept.
So this would be law. It's your baby. Do you have dreams of it going national one day?
Would love to. Would love to. If it's successful and people feel it's a viable option, we would love to have it go beyond Wisconsin.
Have you, you're working with a couple of legislators, as you said, but have you gotten any sort of feelers from other people saying, you know, this is interesting and I'm interested for maybe both sides of the aisle?
Well, I think what happened is the subcommittee, there are a variety of people on the subcommittee, and we went far and wide. There were about 50 different organizations we tapped into and individuals in a variety of different professions, and they all said, let's go for it. Let's really pursue this and see if we can make this happen.
So obviously getting a law like this passed is something that you have a lot invested in. What is your hope about how it would affect people and how they move into their later years in life?
I hope this will provide them some more security, that they feel that they have some funds that can be made available to them at the time that they need it. And the nice benefit of this is that if they don't use all of their long-term care insurance, their beneficiary can also use it for their long-term care insurance. So it would be passed down to another generation if there is any funds left over. So it would continue to pay for long-term care.
Well, Ingrid, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your plan with us today.
Thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking to Ingrid Thompson, Director of McFarland Senior Outreach Services.
Said, brother, you got it bad. I know it for sure.
with over 700 bands, a million attendees, and 11 stages used over 11 days, Milwaukee's Summerfest has been certified by the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest music festival on the planet.
And a festival that big attracts all kinds of big names, from Bruno Mars to Brad Paisley, Lady Gaga to Usher, Outkast to Girl Talk. Those artists tour nationally and even globally, but if you want a uniquely Wisconsin musical experience at this year's Summerfest, there are lots of local acts, too.
Here with us to share some unmissable Wisconsin acts, we have Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Guys, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, before we get to the Wisconsin stuff specifically, what are you looking forward to the most at this year's Summerfest?
Oh, that's a good question and a hard one to answer. I think that this is a really good lineup this year. I've written about this before. It seems to me to be, for the years I've covered it as a freelance writer and full-time as a music writer at the Journal Sentinel, I think it's the best lineup they've had since I've covered it. There's just a lot of modern, relevant, kind of youthful acts. You talked about Bruno Mars, Lady Gaga. Luke Bryan is just the top of the country world right now. Reunite Outkast is playing. One Republic is playing. You've got New Order, you've got Fall Out Boy, Paramore, it's just, there's a lot of really good stuff. Usher, it's his only U.S. Summer date.
Really?
And he's playing closing night. Yeah. It's a really good lineup. I'm really impressed by it, and I think a lot of people are.
So those are the national names. Let's dig into Wisconsin now. And in a piece you wrote, a preview piece, you picked a list of the top local artists to check out for each day, and we're going to survey some of those. They kick it off Wednesday, the 25th, and you chose the band Tweed Funk. Tell us a little bit about them, please.
Yeah, Tweed Funk is just a really fun, kind of funky soul band. They had an album that came out a month or two ago, maybe, called First Name Lucky. And I listened to it, and it was just a really kind of, it's just really good soul funk music. It just, you feel good listening to it. I was tapping my toes, all that kind of stuff. And that's on the album. I think live, they're going to be much more exciting. I think generally those kinds of songs are much better live than even on record. And on record, it was a lot of fun. And the cool thing, too, is it's a blend of originals and covers. And the originals sound just as good as the covers, which I think is really a testament that, they sounded, their own songs sound just as good as some older, a little more time-tested soul gems. So it's definitely one to check out for sure.
And we've got a clip of them. We've got a clip of their song Sugarfoot to check out.
Cool.
Sugarfoot called me last night. He said his girl called him up. She said, can I come over? He said, yeah.
And you can see where that's going to translate really well on the stage, I think, Piet. I see what you were talking about.
Oh, it's so much fun. And they're playing at 5 o'clock on Johnson Controls World Sound Stage. So definitely worth getting there and starting out your festa in the afternoon if you can for them. It's going to be a blast, I'm sure.
And on Thursday, you picked a local throwback to the late 70s and early 80s. Tell us about Yipes.
Yeah, this is of all the local acts playing this year, this is maybe the most interesting booking. Yipes was a power pop band. It featured Pat McCurdy, who a lot of people know who he is, and he's played Summerfest over and over and over again in a million other places around the state and beyond. Mike Hoffman from Semi-Twang is also in that group. So they were together in the late 70s, early 80s. They actually got a record deal, released two albums within like 3 years. They did some shows, like opening for Cheap Trick. They opened for Foreigner. But the sales were kind of lackluster, even though the songs are good. So they were dropped, and the band just kind of disbanded, and McCurdy went and did his thing, and Hoffman did his thing, and they all kind of did their own thing. So last year at the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards, they were inducted into the Whammy Hall of Fame, and they came back together to play like a 15-minute set of songs. It seemed like kind of maybe a one-time sort of deal, but apparently they're coming back for more, and this time they're going to play a lot more than 15 minutes. So I think that'll be a lot of fun, too.
We've got Out in California from a 1979 album, I guess, before the label dropped, and let's give a listen. Sounds a little like late 70s, almost surf punk there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just kind of light and fun, and I think it'll be cool. And, you know, all those guys are all still pretty active. They're still at it. So, you know, they sounded good when they were together for 15 minutes. I think that they'll still sound pretty solid for a full set. So they're actually headlining a night of other Wisconsin bands that have gotten together. So there's going to be a few throwback bands on that stage. It's Johnson Controls World Sound Stage, the 26th. Yipes plays at 10 p.m.
Who are some of those other bands getting back together for that show?
Oh, man.
You've got them off the top of your head.
Oh, I'm trying to remember. Oh my gosh, because you've got me. Because there's so many band names kind of floating around in my
yeah,
head.
Yeah, I bet.
I'm totally
11 stages, 11 days. You do the math. Yeah, that's a lot out there.
Oh, there's some good ones whose names totally escape me embarrassingly, and if they pop in my brain during our little chat, I will give a little shout-out. Yeah.
I'm going to jump to the last couple days of the show. People getting out there on the holidays can check out Harvey Scales, Milwaukee's own, I understand, grandfather of soul. Can you tell us a little bit about Harvey Scales?
Yeah, Harvey Scales, he's 71. He lives in Atlanta now. But, yeah, he is kind of known as the godfather of soul. He had a couple hits. One was called Love Itis. One was called Disco Lady. There's actually in Milwaukee, there's this thing called The Get Down. And it's this monthly vintage soul and funk dance party. And they play, national stuff. A lot of it's very rare. But they also play a lot of local stuff, too. And there's actually a song called The Get Down, I believe by Harvey Scales. So, he's kind of seen, his stuff will kind of appear in those dance set lists. So, for anyone who's kind of going to those parties, those parties, by the way, are just a lot of fun. You should definitely check it out if you can, if you're in Milwaukee for one of those. But this is a chance to kind of see the real deal. I mean, he lives in Atlanta, doesn't perform all that often around town these days. So it's one to see. And he opens, he and his band open for Kool and the Gang. So it's going to be kind of a fun doubleheader that night.
Can we still claim him as Milwaukee's own, as Wisconsin's own, even though he lives in Atlanta?
If he's the godfather of Milwaukee soul or funk or whatever, then yeah, I mean, you know, that's his nickname. I think we can still claim him, sure.
Okay, so
he just wants warmer weather. Who can blame him?
We started off with this. Let's give a little more to Love Itis by Harvey Scales.
You said the only one that can fill your prescription. Oh, yeah. And this feeling I got. Got but one description. I think you got a thing called love. It's got a hold on me.
Should be a pretty good show, it sounds like, Piet.
Yeah, he's at 8 p.m. at the BMO Harris Pavilion on Independence Day, again, opening for Kool and the Gang. I think it will be a good one. Also, earlier we talked about Yipes was headlining a night of some Milwaukee bands that were reuniting. They are back in my brain who those other bands are. That includes the Wigs. They're playing at 8:30 on that stage. That's going to be one to definitely check out. And Bon Ton Society as well. They're playing at 6:30 on that stage.
And then wrapping up the festival on July 5th, Wisconsin's own Kane Place Record Club, not so much in the throwback category we've been doing. How long have they been around?
They've been around for a few years. They're really popular around town. I feel like they play basically any festival that happens in Milwaukee, and they get around a bit. They're just a really interesting band. They've got the soul thing going for them too, but they're kind of soul pop. Their tempos will change. They're really unpredictable. They're really exciting live. One of the best live bands we've got in Milwaukee right now. They've got this amazing music video for a single called Sunshine that, and the song itself is like, and if you see the video, it reminds me of like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. There's like weird animation stuff happening, and the song just takes all these bizarre twists and turns. It's just kind of whimsical and funky, and it's cool. It's cool. This band is very cool, so I think that'll be a lot of fun too. They're at 9 p.m. on the KNE New Music Stage on July 5th.
Well, we'll play that exciting music video now. Everyone listening will just hear the audio portion, of course.
Yes, check it out, jsonline.com/summerfest. We've got it up there.
All right, here's Sunshine.
I long ago to hell. My nickname wasn't Shine. I was 12. And think about my grandma dying. Cause the water won't rise unless you're crying.
So that's kind of the beginning of an epic, Piet?
Yeah, and it gets really kind of weird, and it gets really dark and heavy, and then it gets really playful and jazzy, and I really haven't heard a song like it before. I mean, locally, beyond locally, I think they've really kind of tapped onto something very unique. And so, I think they, you know, they're definitely popular here, and I think they'll continue to grow, and I think that set will be a lot of fun and should have a pretty good crowd of people, and hopefully listeners will check it out too if they're around on the 5th.
All right, Piet, we've had a lot of the local Wisconsin act, or at least acts with Wisconsin ties. Which national act are you most excited to see of some of the ones you mentioned?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, I'm really excited for Usher because it's his only U.S. set this summer. I think that's really a cool get. He's got a song called Good Kisser that I think is really fun. It just came out, so it'll probably be the first time we hear that and first time we hear a lot of those songs from his upcoming album. I think Motley Crue will be kind of fun because it's their final tour, and I'm sure, you know, they're so over the top. I think they're just going to bring it for that. New Order should be great on the 3rd. Bonnie Raitt on the 2nd. Nas, he's celebrating the 20th anniversary of Illmatic, which is like a hip hop classic. That should be really cool. Outkast, I'm pumped for Outkast. I can't wait to see them.
So I had a big boy and Andre for me. I got to ask before let you go. Do you have dining plans? What foods are you looking to check out during Summerfest?
Well, at jsonline.com/summerfest, we have a list of 10 food vendors to try out. I always get the Seals mini donuts with the powdered sugar and cinnamon sugar in there. It's not necessarily dinner, but it's delicious. You got to get the cheese sticks, of course, from Saz's, eggplant from Venice Club, which I think is 65 cents from noon to 3 on the 28th. It's like a throwback price.
Wow.
And then there's a new vendor called Burke's Lakeside, and they're doing mac and cheese bratwurst. That sounds awesome. So I'm going to definitely get one of those.
Put me down from eggplant with a little lemon with that. Piet, thank you for joining us today.
Cool. Thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it.
That's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy sharing Wisconsin acts at this year's Summerfest.